The third case of the morning is number 03-1450, Gerard N. Haas against the State of Wisconsin et al. Mr. Bernhoff.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Robert Bernhoff, I represent Gerard Haas, the plaintiff appellant in this matter before the court on appeal. Two important questions presented here for the court's consideration. First, whether a municipal court can imprison a man without commencing an action against him. And second, may a municipal court judge imprison a man at hard labor unless or until he pays his debt to the municipality? Significant questions of 14th Amendment due process and 13th Amendment teenage violations.
Now, and there are issues with respect to both of them, because of course the municipal court didn't out of the blue just go grab Mr. Haas and pop him in jail. There had been proceedings from the citations and the ordinance violations and a default judgment and a follow-up, which I think is the context we have to keep in mind. Secondly, you have to explain to me where you're getting this term hard labor from. It appears all over the place in your brief, and I couldn't tell from either your brief or the appellee's brief or anything else I saw that he had to do anything, you know, but watch TV while he was in the jail.
Yes, Judge. These were hard labor body executions, as evidenced by the face of the commitments themselves.
But what does
and
that
we
alleged.
Well, it meant that the judge ordered Haas committed at the Racine County Common Jail at hard labor.
Well, but what do they do at the Racine County Jail? I mean, where does it say that, and what does it actually mean?
Well, on this record, we don't precisely know what the sheriff or the keeper of the Racine County Common Jail would do in response to a hard labor body execution. I do know when I drive down I-94 coming to Chicago, we do see some road crews and people in orange jumpsuits picking up highways. I don't suggest that, and we don't believe that they're making little rocks from big rocks at the Racine County Common Jail, and yet the face of the commitments themselves, as alleged in the complaint, order Haas's commitment at hard labor. That is was the arrest order of Judge Michelson. Now, with respect to the Judge Wood's point about there were proceedings, we certainly can see that there was a proceeding before the municipal court, but under Wisconsin law, the mere filing and issuance of a citation does not constitute commencement of an action.
The district court disagreed with you and had quite a lengthy discussion about the history of Wisconsin law in this respect.
Yes, and we take issue with the district court's analysis of Wisconsin law. It really comes down to this with respect to the due process claim. In order for the defendants to prevail here, they must convince this court that the citation procedure statute passed in 1975, which for the first time permitted municipalities to use citation procedures, did not govern the citation procedure that was initiated against Haas.
Now, of course, at worst, this only goes to the court's personal jurisdiction. It has nothing to do with the court's subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, we respectfully disagree, Your Honor. When you have a situation where you have a statute that provides a voluntary consent procedure by which ordinance violations can be adjudicated. It's a very carefully, clearly, and constitutionally crafted statute. It has specific provisions that subject matter jurisdiction in a citation procedure only arises upon the affirmative act of the alleged violator.
It doesn't say that, though. I mean, it really doesn't say that. It's talking about how do we know that the defendant is properly before the court. Maybe he consents, maybe he pays a deposit, maybe the citation is enough in and of itself after the various amendments. That's all about making sure that before a default judgment is entered, this person has been officially notified, because you can't run a civilized society if people who are accused of things can be properly notified and say, well, I've decided not to go to court today, I'm just not going to comply with the law. That's not acceptable.
Yes, Haas was not properly notified. It's axiomatic that federal law in all states.
He received the citation.
Yes, he received the citation.
So he knew that he was accused of. And so the only question is that form of notice something constitutionally mandated under the 14th Amendment, or is the 14th Amendment more flexible with respect to the types of notice the states choose to give.
Yes. There are two questions there, I believe, and I can unpack them. The first with respect to whether the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause requires more than a mere citation. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has felt that it did in I.D.B. Skirbeck. And
also that's not binding on us.
No, certainly not, but we suggest that it's persuasive in terms of interpreting Wisconsin law.
That's not Wisconsin law that you're talking about right now, though. You're talking about the federal constitution, the 14th Amendment.
I.D.B. Skirbeck pointed to the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause and observed that that clause required the service and filing of a summons and complaint prior to any judgment being entered, even where the party had actual notice of the proceeding. And we just merely point to that as persuasive authority. Now, with respect to the statute itself, there's clear language there, and it has not been changed, even though the statute was slightly modified in 1988 and 1991. It indicates that there is no subject matter jurisdiction for that court until the alleged violator either tenders the deposit or makes that personal appearance. The statute says unambiguously, the mere filing and issuance of a citation does not constitute commencement of an action. And on this point, I think it's significant that the Wisconsin legislature sought to immunize citation issuers in the citation procedure statute, section 0113, from criminal prosecution for simulating legal process. And they did that because if there was any question about these citations being mere invitations to appear in court, and somebody believed differently or was told differently, there could be an arguable criminal prosecution. That's right in the citation procedure statute. Also, I would point out that the Wisconsin Attorney General agrees with Haas's interpretation of this issue. In a 1988 Attorney General opinion, the Attorney General opines that until the person cited either appears or makes the deposit, that court has severely circumscribed subject matter jurisdiction. It goes directly to the question of subject matter jurisdiction. On this point, I would lastly observe that where the statute says there has been no commencement of action, no court, federal or state or municipal, would move forward, conduct any proceeding, or take any action or make any order. What you really have here is a municipal corporation usurping state sovereignty.
Maybe you should discuss Rooker-Feldman for a minute.
Certainly. Rooker-Feldman did not deprive the district court of jurisdiction. It's, of course, a discretionary jurisdictional declination.
Rooker-Feldman did not. Rooker-Feldman goes to our subject matter jurisdiction, the question whether federal courts can substitute for taking proper appeals within the state system.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not discretionary.
What I meant to say, and I misspoke, is that this issue was raised, of course, as is appropriate, sua sponte, by the district court. None of the defendants raised that issue, of course. Rooker-Feldman is based on the doctrine that federal courts are not empowered to perform appellate review of state court judgments. Several points on this fact. Number one, this is not a state court. This is a franchise court of extremely limited jurisdiction.
But so it's possible to take an appeal from that municipal court, which actually Wisconsin does regard as a state court, to another state court in Wisconsin. And if that avenue is available, it doesn't really matter if Mr. Haas availed himself of it or not. That's enough to say that's the way you address this. And as a matter of fact, if you remember the case Thompson against City of Louisville, from the Supreme Court, even if there were no appeal from that municipal court to any other court in the state of Wisconsin, you could still file a petition for certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court under 1257,
yes,
which is exactly what happened in Thompson City of Louisville.
Well, I would respectfully point out that the question, the issue of whether there were alternative appellate procedures available to Haas, is not part of the Rooker-Feldman analysis.
It certainly is. It's the question is, do you have a way to raise this in Wisconsin? Because otherwise, we can't come in and be the Wisconsin appellate body.
I would make a, with regard to that, what we have here is a situation where, for example, Judge Posner talked about in the Nessies case, which is a very illuminating case regarding the intricacies of Rooker-Feldman doctrine. And he points out that even if a Section 1983 suit in federal court denied a legal conclusion of a state court, and yet, if the plaintiff asserts separate, independent constitutional violation claims, it is not barred by Rooker-Feldman. I would point out that in the case of our 13th Amendment peonage claim, these hard labor body executions issued in one case over 12 months after the proceeding was included. That is an act that is done outside of the proceeding, sua sponte, by the municipal court judge for his employer, the municipal corporation.
And it never would have happened if he had succeeded in setting aside this finding of a violation of the ordinances through the procedures Wisconsin makes available.
Well, the exhaustion of state administrative remedies, including appellate remedies.
Not an administrative remedy. It's a court remedy for a court decision.
Yes.
And it's the court decision that he doesn't agree with, namely that he violated the ordinances and owes the money.
That's not what he disagrees with. And I would point out to the defendants in their brief...
He just never has to pay the money that Wisconsin has assessed in these
proceedings? No, absolutely not. That's a red herring that was brought up by the defendants and in the district court opinion. There are a multitude of remedies for the municipal corporation to collect its forfeitures. In fact, the citation procedure statute advises the municipality to proceed to file a forfeiture collection action where the alleged violator neither appears in court or tenders the deposit. And that's absolutely untrue that the municipality would be left without remedy. And that's the remedy, of course, that they sought prior to 1975 before citation procedures became available. I would point out that the defendants themselves in their brief on page 3 urged that Haas does not argue that he was innocent of the ordinance violations or otherwise contest the substantive validity of the municipal court judgments. That's precisely correct, and that's precisely why Rooker-Feldman does not deprive the court of jurisdiction. If it were true that state court proceedings that violated constitutional rights could be immune from federal court collateral review on 1983, by the application of a jurisdiction doctrine like Rooker-Feldman, then an entire species of allegedly unconstitutional activity would be beyond federal court review. And that issue also arises in the 13th Amendment peonage claims.
But aren't you arguing essentially that the state courts have no power to apply the federal constitution? Because if there were a federal constitutional violation in lower state court proceedings, then one of two things can happen. Either that can be asserted on appeal to higher courts in the state, and they can assess the federal constitutional issues and see if inappropriate procedures or other actions were being taken, or you could think that perhaps the state courts were powerless to correct their own federal constitutional violation. The problem with Theory 2 is the supremacy clause, in a word. It's clear that the state courts not only can, but do on a daily basis enforce the federal constitution.
It's not a question of whether Haas had alternative appellate remedies or whether the municipal court can entertain a constitutional question. Rooker-Feldman asks this question. Does this Section 1983 plaintiff assert constitutional violations that are independent of the merits of the judgments of the state court? That is the evaluation under Nessies and its progeny. What we have here, it's not a question of whether Haas shoveled his snow in a timely fashion or didn't cut his grass to the prescribed ordinance limit. He's not challenging the substantive merits of the judgments. These allegations, particularly the 13th Amendment peonage claim, is absolutely separate and distinct from the merits of the municipal ordinance violation case. You have a situation where over 12 months after the proceeding concluded, a judge orders these hard labor body executions. And one final point on this matter, if this is the self-confessed official custom and policy of the city defendants, that's beyond dispute. They've said that this is the way we do it, it's prescribed by statute, we're going to continue to do it. And if this practice is given federal judicial imprimatur, what you have is a situation where Judge Mankelson at one point demanded that Haas pay $76,000 or spend 5 years in jail at hard labor. There would be absolutely no limit to the authority of a municipal court in Wisconsin to imprison for debt. And that's precisely what it is.
But why did he bother to show that he was indigent? That's crazy. I mean, it's just, he wouldn't have been imprisoned if he couldn't pay, and if he thought it was an inappropriate order, he could have taken an appeal and gotten it reversed.
Indigency.
Maybe he owes $76,000. I don't know what he owes.
Indigency goes to questions of equal protection, not to due process.
No, it goes to whether he would be in prison.
No, it does not.
It goes to whether he would be imprisoned, because he can't be imprisoned if he's indigent.
Respectfully, Judge Wood, what we have in the Wisconsin statutory scheme, and this occurred in the early 1980s, a concern that indigency or someone without resources would be jailed, whereas a person with resources would be able to pay the forfeiture and survive. And so those issues were addressed. And we would point out in Pulliam v. Allen, the same issue was presented, very similar to the case at hand. The United States Supreme Court said injunctive relief is available. There's no judicial immunity. This practice of incarcerating individuals for non-incarcerable offenses is unconstitutional. The analogies are very strong. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bernhoff. I hear now from Mr. Braithwaite.
Thank you, Your Honors. Attorney Ryan Braithwaite appears on behalf of Racine County Sheriff's Department, Sheriff William McReynolds.
And exactly what is pending against the county?
Well, the county's role in this was simply as the custodian. The city presented Mr. Hoff to the county under state statutes. The county is required to take Mr. Hoff into custody. You know, the record at this point does not really show exactly what was done, given the procedural posture of this case.
What's the allegation against the county?
Well, the allegation is that we should have known that these commitments were facially invalid because of the arguments presented in regard to the subject matter jurisdiction, peonage, everything else, that these officers should have realized that, and they should have said, no, we will not accept this. This is improper. This violates the Constitution. Now, we think that's ludicrous, but in any case, you know, the arguments really reveal that this is a state law matter. I mean, we have federal constitutional claims, but they all come back to state law procedures. I mean, it's an argument over, you know, how is an action commenced? You know, and to say that there's no subject matter jurisdiction for a municipal court over a municipal ordinance violation, just, I don't understand it at all. You know, the only issue in terms of judicial immunity, which applies to the county officers by virtue of, you know, the ability to follow a judge's process and not to have a duty to independently question an order of a judge, you know, that issue, as the court noted, only goes to, you know, is a personal jurisdiction issue. I mean, the subject matter jurisdiction, I don't see as an issue in this case. I would like to address the Younger Doctrine and the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. The Younger Doctrine, of course, is discretionary. Rooker-Feldman is not. And in this case, the court applied quite properly the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, because really what we're talking about here is the injury is the remedy that the court ordered. And the Nessus case, which the appellant has cited, noted that Rooker-Feldman should be confined to cases in which the defendant is seeking to undo a remedial order. I mean, you go to the state statute, 800.095, the sanctions imposed by the court for nonpayment are a remedial order. I mean, that's demonstrated in the Kilgore case, which I believe my co-counsel will be touching on in a moment, where they're talking about the authority to suspend a driver's license as a remedial sanction, which was given after the power to imprisonment. That case talks all about the power to imprison defendants who choose not to avail themselves of process, which, you know, the irony of this case in terms of the 14th Amendment due process argument is you have an individual who refused to avail himself of the process that was available. He decided he was going to make a stand, and he was going to say, this is the way that you must collect this money, and I'm going to stand on my rights, and we think he did so incorrectly and at his peril. I think the Hamala case is very instructive. It was also noted by the district court, you know, you have a case where the alleged injuries result from the orders of a judge, and that's indisputable here. You know, and in that case, you know, the court noted that Rooker-Feldman would not bar federal review if during the state court proceedings the plaintiff had no reasonable opportunity to raise the claims he now raises. Well, he could have raised them in municipal court. He could have raised them in circuit court. He did raise them in the Haas versus State versus McReynolds case that went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The court didn't reach those issues, but they were certainly raised. And getting back to the subject matter jurisdiction issue, you know, the municipal court power, you know, extends beyond statute when we're talking about a municipal situation. The Kenosha versus Jensen case says that within the confines of a municipal ordinance violation, the municipal court has the power to vacate a void judgment irrespective of statutory requirements. You know, municipal court power is very significant within the limited subject matter area of municipal ordinance violations. I mean, the cases dealing with judicial immunity, you know, talk about if a probate judge were to try to, you know, hold a criminal case, that's the kind of situation where you're acting in the clear absence of jurisdiction and judicial immunity would not apply to the city or the county as it passes through the judge. But where a judge of a criminal court convicts a defendant of a non-existent crime, that is just acting in excess of jurisdiction. Now, we don't concede that Judge Michelson acted in excess of his jurisdiction, but certainly that's all we're talking about here at worst. You know, in terms of the statutory analysis, we agree completely with the district court. You know, I think it's quite clear that Chapter 800 is the more specific municipal court procedure. You take a look at the things that it says to put on the citation. I mean, you have a statute telling you to put in the citation that you can be defaulted for failure to appeal. Now, why would a statute give advice that is apparently contrary to statute? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It obviates the need for most of Chapter 800. You know, and if you look at the opinion of the Attorney General that has been mentioned, in that analysis, although we disagree with it, and the district court did, it was framed in terms of personal jurisdiction, not subject matter jurisdiction. And again, I just don't see the issue with subject matter jurisdiction. You know, when we have all these concepts of peonage and everything else, but they just don't seem to apply to this case.
So what's this hard labor stuff?
Well, apparently it's listed on the face of the commitment. You know, there certainly is no allegation in the complaint that he was anything other than incarcerated in a county jail. I've been to the Racine County Jail. I've not seen anything to suggest that there's hard labor going on there. You know, maybe there are road crews on the side of the road, but you know, we don't know what those are about. But certainly, he was never subject to hard labor. You know, it's an attempt to really elevate the rhetoric in this case to make it look like we've got this situation where you know this government is going beyond its power. And really, I think
isn't that a 14th Amendment due process or 8th Amendment sort of claim? You know, if somebody's been convicted and they're being held in conditions that are cruel and unusual,
yes,
couldn't they make a claim?
It would be, but you know, those claims were not made. The claim here is simply that, and really if you look at the hard labor argument, you know, it's being used in a way to say that it's improper to even require someone to pay, because the payment represents a certain quantum of his labor. Well, if that's true, then how can you ever have, you know, how can you ever coerce a monetary payment in a civil case? Because you'd have, you know, under that rationale, only in a criminal case can you force somebody to pay money. You know, and that just also seems strange to me. But I think my time is done. I'm going to defer to my colleague, and I thank the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Braithwaite. We'll hear now from Mr. Lewis.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Lewis, and I represent the City of Racine and the City of Racine defendants, including the City of Racine Police and Municipal Judge Robert Michelson. I'd like to briefly address four points raised by Mr. Haas in this matter. First, Mr. Haas was charged, and we have to emphasize this, under the Racine ordinances, under the procedures of Chapter 800 of the Wisconsin Statutes, which is the Municipal Court Procedure Act, as it existed in 1997 and 1998, which is when these ordinance violations were issued, and the statute continues to exist in the same way today. And all the discussion by Mr. Haas as to how the law may or may not have existed back in the 1970s and 1980s is not germane to this case. And contrary to Mr. Haas's repeated assertions in his reply brief before this court, Racine did adopt Chapter 800 of the Wisconsin Statutes in its entirety. But let's assume for the sake of the argument we had not adopted Chapter 800, which is the Municipal Court Procedure Act. We would still be bound by it once we created our municipal court. Under state law, we have the option of creating a municipal court or not creating a municipal court, but once we do, in our view, all the procedures under Chapter 800 are mandatory. We cannot opt out of this state law, and we are bound by its procedures whether we like them or not. Now, Chapter 66, which is repeatedly cited by Mr. Haas, is the general municipal chapter of the Wisconsin Statutes, and it has no relevance to this case other than to make for an interesting and often confusing diversion. In fact, Chapter 66 twice indicates that Chapter 800 governs most of the time in proceedings in municipal court. For example, Chapter 66 says The law states that, quote, if an action is to be in municipal court, the citation under section 800.022 shall be issued. And if you look at the law, there's a whole panoply of rights and responsibilities that are printed on the citation. This is also by law. One of them is the fact that if you don't show up in court, you will be deemed to have defaulted and you can be committed. Then all the confusion as to the collection procedure for ordinance violation procedures is eliminated by the verbiage which says, if the action is in municipal court, the procedures under Chapter 800 apply and the procedures under this section do not apply. In essence, Mr. Haas's case is a game of dominoes. He alleges that if the initial domino falls, everything thereafter is illegal and unconstitutional. And the initial domino, according to Mr. Haas, is the commencement of the action against him for the ordinance violations with which he is charged. He contends that the Racine Municipal Court has neither personal or subject matter jurisdiction over him because he was not served with both a citation and a summons. But this position flies in the face of law and logic. First, the citation, which again, Chapter 66 must be used in municipal court cases, specifically advises the defendant when and where he must appear, the nature of the violation, the penalty, and that he may be defaulted for non-appearance, among several other items which are not normally found on the traditional summons. And second, another section under Chapter 800 states the defendant may be defaulted upon proof that he was personally served with a summons or a citation. It's not in the conjunctive, it's in the disjunctive. And further, the law said, quote, the court may enter a default judgment by reason of the failure of the defendant to respond to a citation or a summons. Again, it's in the disjunctive, it's not in the conjunctive. There's no dispute that Mr. Haas received his citations. He just chose to ignore them, and he decided to ignore our municipal court. He did not contend that he actually showed up for his initial appearance, or for his trial, or for his indigency hearing. He does not contend that he filed a timely judgment after, he did not file a timely appeal after a judgment was entered against him, and he did not avail himself of section 800.115, which is the procedure to request relief from a judgment in municipal court.
Did the appeals go to the circuit court?
Appeals go to the circuit court, that is correct.
Right, and is it a de novo standard of review, or is it a deferential?
You can do it one of two ways. You can do it on the transcript, that is before the municipal court, so the circuit judge just reads it, but that is still a de novo determination based on the evidence before the circuit court. Or you can get, and most, 99% of the people that I've dealt with in municipal court for 15 years, choose the trial de novo. In other words, fresh evidence,
start
everything.
Start over again, okay.
Yeah. So you have 20 days, and once you're notified of the judgment, to appeal to the circuit court, which is a court of record. The municipal court is technically not a court of record, even though we do record the proceedings in order to fulfill the requirement that we submit a transcript if you want to have a review on the transcript. Now, since he failed to appear or challenge the judgments against him, Racine Municipal Court Judge Robert Michelson properly exercised his authority in issuing the commitments against Mr. Haas. As alluded to earlier, a judge only yields his absolute immunity when he's acting outside his jurisdiction and not in excess of his jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is not relevant, as a matter of fact, when addressing judicial immunity or the lack thereof. As long as the judge has subject matter jurisdiction, the judge's personal feelings for the defendant is irrelevant. The judge can even be mistaken. But Mr. Haas offers up nothing to show that the Racine Municipal Court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. Indeed, Wisconsin Statute 755.0451, of which the district court took note, states that, quote, a municipal court has exclusive jurisdiction over an action in which a municipality seeks to impose forfeitures for violations of municipal ordinances of the municipality which operates the court. Now, judicial immunity aside, Judge Michelson hypothetically could have made a technical error not in strict conformance with Wisconsin law, yet this error does not necessarily rise to the level of a constitutional tort actionable under Section 1983. Third, Mr. Haas contends that his commitments were unlawful. However, the Wisconsin Supreme Court made short work of that argument in City of Milwaukee versus Kilgore. The Kilgore Court addressed the suspension of the defendant's driver's license as a sanction for failure to pay a forfeiture for an ordinance violation, but the principles it applied as to the driver's license apply equally to the sanction of incarceration. That is, the sanction is remedial, and in the court's words, quote, designed to compel the contender to take affirmative and corrective action to remain in compliance with an existing court order. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Sir, you have 1 minute.
Thank you, Judge. Haas was convicted of neither crime nor contempt. These are the only two exceptions to the 13th Amendment's prohibition against involuntary servitude. Second, with respect to Hamola, Hamola was brought before a court, organic trial court of general jurisdiction. He was served a summons and complaint, an equity order issued ordering Hamola to do something. He refused to do it. A motion for an order to show cause why he shouldn't be held in contempt was issued. He responded. He had a contempt proceeding with full federal constitutional rights because contempt proceedings are criminal, and he was convicted of contempt. Now, while Hamola might have had a lot of things to complain about on the merits, he had no complaint, constitutionally speaking, and there's absolutely no analogy between the facts of Hamola in this case. Now, there's been something said about injunctive relief, judicial immunity. If it were true that the state court judge, in this case a municipal court judge with no criminal jurisdiction, has judicial immunity for the act of incarceration, which was unconstitutional, then the Supreme Court and Pulliam v. Allen would not have allowed that 1983 action to lie. Furthermore, the Supreme Court would have applied Rooker-Feldman, or in some way when it went up to the Fourth Circuit. It's not a requirement that an aggrieved 1983 plaintiff pursue every single conceivable state remedy. He can go right to federal court.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.